my daddy wants to shoot me, he'll have to come here. He wouldn't let me come into his house, not even to shoot me. So if he means to do it, it will have to be right here in this graveyard. It's been a year and a spring and a summer after that since I did what made him want to kill me today. Over 2 years since I found the place again and got everybody interested in helping me to clean it off. It's the only place I wanted to come to after what happened. The local law states that I can be here until sundown. I could probably stay until after dark. I doubt that the local law would come out this far, and this is a family cemetery, private, so the local law may not apply. But I won't stay until after dark. I'll leave in time to catch the plane back to New York City. Between now and then, there is enough time to figure out if I want to make my daddy see that he wouldn't have tried to shoot me if he didn't love me.
Writer Anderson Farrell. He'll be back in just a moment with more from his new novel, Home for the Day. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Later on the program this week, filmmaker Mackie Alston will be here to talk about his new project, a documentary film about race and memory in the American South. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. In Anderson Farrell's new book, Home for the Day, a nameless narrator tells us of his journey homeward with the ashes of his dead lover. He finds himself in the rural southern landscape that earlier in life he abandoned to preserve what Farrell calls the exquisite scandal of his difference. Here the narrator confronts secrets, ironies, and simple family truths. With an excerpt from Home for the Day, here is Anderson Farrell.
Wayne, here's a passage which sort of first introduces the relationship between the narrator and his dead lover, Pete. And it comes about as a consequence of a conversation the narrator has had with his mother while he's been doing her hair. I knew what she meant about wanting more than anything to touch Daddy. But that day in front of the mirror, and for a long time after, I was ashamed of her and of myself. I felt that way until I met Pete. I came home from New York to try to explain, only to her, about Pete and me, to tell her that I too had found someone unacceptable. She tried to understand, but don't tell your daddy. On that visit home, when I was grown and happy in love, she finished her story. She told me she had come to think that Daddy had taken her to his house that day to show her what she would be getting, to somehow forewarn her and give her the opportunity to avoid it, him, the life she was to have. Just wanted me to know the worst right off, I guess. But Daddy knew what he was doing. No doubt she saw just what she wanted to see. She was only half what she thought she was. He was half what she was. They were married by the summer after the fall they had met. Do you know the worst that could happen with you and this Pete? I am the fool who answered yes to that question.
Anderson Farrell, welcome to the National Humanities Center. Congratulations on this wonderful novel you have written. Tell our listeners what happens in Home for the Day.
What happens is largely in the mind of the narrator. The book is a series of recollections and memories, planned and random, told by a man who has buried the ashes of his lover of 17 years in his family's ancestral graveyard in eastern North Carolina. And he has returned after a year after having done this, thinking that he can make it up with his family and that this was a way to sort of come to terms with them and for them to come to terms with him. And when he steps into the front yard of his father's house, his father shoots at him. So he goes back to the graveyard, not having being able to come home, and he goes back to the graveyard and sits there for the rest of that day until his plane is, until he can get a plane back to New York City. And he recalls the events of his life, which he thinks have led to this pass.
Is there a reason that you have not given your narrator a name? Names help us to place people and things and to get a handle on them.
Yes.
Why is it that we have this unknown quality here?
Well, I think it's simply a matter of how the book spun itself out in my own head. There never came an occasion for him to have a name. He's alone in this graveyard all day long, remembering these things, And how often do you call your own name?
Anderson Farrell, we are talking about your novel, Home for the Day. Let me ask you to read to us from your novel. Please tell me what goes on in this passage.
Wayne, this is one of the crucial scenes in the book toward the end, and it's when the narrator goes fishing with his father. This is the time between loss and memory, the only present my childhood will have. It is a happy day. The day called One of These Days has come. I had, before this day, only watched as my daddy made his preparations for fishing, a careful ritual, its sequence and accoutrements always the same. Often I've stood by, jealously watching him go back and forth at his steady, unharried pace between his pickup truck and the shed where he keeps his tackle, ice chests, and bait buckets. I've tried to let him know that I want to go with him. I've never begged, made a tearful plea, or even a simple request to be taken along. For the private place to which he retreats as he gathers together his fishing tackle is not somewhere I am invited. I have stood and observed and from outside his attention learned how to behave. There is intimacy here between him and his passion, and to intrude or ask to be included or offer help even would be as unacceptable, as impossible as trying to invade someone's sorrow. I'd like to go fishing sometime is all I have ever said. I try to sound dispassionate, and do, I think, for if he sees that I am sick with hopefulness, he does not show it. One of these days is his reply, and he goes on with his preparations, which are careful of purpose, economical of movement, worked out over his fishing life, so that he does not exert himself by a blink of an eye beyond what is required. The equipment is not abused or even handled one time more than is needed to get it in order and loaded. He goes quietly about his work, his face is calm, and I always wonder where his mind floats at these times. I can only say he is fishing and not fishing. I will come to hear some day of states of grace and perfect harmony, and when it is explained to me, Daddy getting ready to fish will be the illustration my mind supplies. And when I am not on the mind of the one I wish to be, and I have that feeling I get of always being left out for the rest of my life from everything, it is the same sadness I felt watching Daddy get ready to go fishing that overtakes me. But back to that morning which rushes to me here by Pete's grave, rushes toward me as my mind winds back until that morning nestles inside this afternoon like an object the same shape as the box in which it is stored.
Anderson Farrell, we're talking about your novel, Home for the Day. You've just read a critical passage here, that is to say, the fishing trip. What is it that compels the father to take this kid on this trip, and the mother, too, to allow them into this private world that he has?
I think what compels the father is that he knows the son's secret, and it's a way that in which he can bring that secret into the light.
And he, accept it? Does he? Is it?
No,
do we go that far?
It, correct it. Uh-huh. The narrator has a little graveyard that he makes with small animals and bugs and
That's
things
right.
killed. And the father has watched him make this. The narrator doesn't know that his father has seen it. He thinks he's hidden it, and he knows instinctually that he must hide this from his father because it's again his identity. Which is connected to the female members of his family. He says it's woman's work, uh-huh. what I do, the care of the dead and the care of the sick.
Well, apropos of that, let me ask you to read this passage about the secret graveyard. Again, we're talking about Home for the Day. Read this passage. Tell me what goes on in this passage.
Wayne, in this section, the young narrator is, I think, coming to terms with his sexual identity, certainly, and his gender identity. If you'll allow me to say that. It's women's work I do. On hot summer days when all the other boys are swimming or playing baseball or going howling wild in the woods and fields which are running distance from anywhere in town, I slip away behind my grandmother's wash house and arrange funerals. I spend long hours making caskets out of cigar boxes, humming somber but hopeful hymns. Since the time I discovered I wasn't a girl, but gave up anyway trying to join the race of boys, I have buried things. Dignified burials I give to frogs car smashed in the street at night, beetles killed by DDT, which is sprayed all over town by the county health department to keep down mosquitoes, resting ground which only my imagination has hallowed. In the waveless quiet of this real graveyard, I wonder what was the peace and happiness I found in my pretend cemetery. I wonder where it is. With its miniature mounds all covered with flowers picked from my grandmother's cutting garden, and its tiny rock borders and tombstones easily chipped off pieces of slate which fall from the roof of my grandmother's house, this tiny cemetery is where I live on summer's days, from the fleeting cool of the early morning until the cool returns at evening, and, I would say, happily.
Anderson, there's, not to put too morbid a spin on the conversation, but there's a kind of a death dimension in this novel. After all, your narrator has come home after the death of his lover, Pete, and here you've just read a passage, a little boy who's, is it fair to say he's obsessed with dead things? Are you taking this a little too far here? What?
He's obsessed with burying things. And I think in his... in his way, and in his at the time of life he feels a deeper, darker, bigger secret. He feels compelled to bury a deeper, darker, bigger secret, and he's acting this out. I think.
Well, what I'm leading you to is this: is this book, Anderson? Is it about life or is it about death? I mean, you know, in a way, it is a separate experience. A little boy who discovers that he's gay, mm-hmm. and eventually has to cope with this, come to terms with it with his parents. It's also, and you know, to come back to the social dimension here, this is an AIDS novel. Is that what we should call it?
No, I wouldn't. I think it's...
Tell me why.
I think AIDS is secondary to it. I think it's about loss. I also think that it is about discovering the price of one's passions mm-hmm. and paying it.
Do you call this gay fiction? What I'm trying to do here, Anderson, is put you on the defensive a little bit. I mean, there are people who are going to read this book and say, this man has written this novel to make society accept gays and lesbians and a gay lifestyle and to put it into a context of love and loss. Now, am I being too harsh on you?
Yes, I think so.
Explain this to me.
I don't care whether people accept me or... I mean, I care as a political human being whether... the lifestyle is accepted or rejected, or whether I'm afforded my rights as a human being. But I think politics and the making of literature are separate things, and the politics is secondary and a consequence of the thing being good or bad literature.
What does the book mean to you personally?
What it's meant to me personally is that it has helped... along the way, I think this will be my life's work, to find the connection between what I came from and what I became. That does not connect in my mind. I've had a wonderful life and done interesting things and met exciting people, and I came from a town of 300 people in eastern North Carolina.
You grew up on a tobacco farm. This is
on and off. We moved into the town. 300 people.
300. Yeah. This is not what we normally associate with the bohemian life of the big city.
Not at all. And I'm the first college graduate in my immediate family. My father was a truck driver. They're unsophisticated people in the sense that you would normally talk about it. They have a great deal of other kinds of sophistication. So it's never... And then I've lived in New York for 20 years and danced on Broadway and been around the world and met fascinating people and known fascinating people, and I never can quite see how it connects. And so I'm always trying to make that connection.
Well, is this what, the artistic sort of burr under the saddle? This is what moves you as an artist?
Yes, yes. And when my friend, the man that I live with, comes down with me to visit my family, we go back and his jaws always drops. He says, I don't see the connection either. It's as though you were dropped from outer space.
Uh-huh.
But there must be one. Of course, there is. I am who they made me. And so the book, on a personal level, was that, and an attempt to put this love that I have for this person that I've lived with and the natural love that I have for my family together in some way, to come to terms with that. It was something that I didn't know that they would accept. They have since been wonderful about it, far beyond my expectations. But I spent a long time trying to figure out how that would how those two things would interweave.
Anderson Farrell is the author of Home for the Day, a novel available from Knopf. His first book, Where She Was, appeared in 1987. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. From Home for the Day to Family Name, I'll be back in just a moment to talk with filmmaker Mackie Alston about his new documentary film project.
Family Name is a documentary film, really about the legacy of slavery in America today. We're focusing on three living families who share the same family name, two black, one white. The white family is my own, and all of the families trace their histories back to the same North Carolina plantations.
Filmmaker Mackie Alston, his new documentary project is Family Name. Alston says that in part, Family Name stems from his memories of growing up in central North Carolina during the struggle over racial integration in the late 60s and early 70s. His parents were activists involved in helping keep the local black school open. One of his playmates included a strong and assertive 7-year-old named Dorothy Alston, whose last name he shared and who later in life helped to inspire his latest project. Family Name is a documentary film about black and white members of the Alston family coming to terms with slavery and a racial legacy only 3 generations removed from that of master and slave. I asked Mackie Alston to talk about his new film and the responses it provokes.
Mostly I get resistance on the white side and on the black side. Initially, I am asking a question or crossing a boundary that has not been crossed, a question that has not been asked. I think we were all socialized simply not to look this issue square in the face, mm-hmm. especially with each other. As black and white people. So I've had some doors slammed. I've had some telephone,
slammed down in your ear.
Ringing in my ear.
Right.
But the miraculous thing, that's the expected thing. That is what I expected. And I knew as an investigator in this way that I was going to have to continue to pursue these conversations, even given the inevitable resistance. Mm-hmm. The miraculous thing is that people have let me in. Ultimately, they have let me in and opened up. And as we have conversed and they have realized my motives, together we have explored conversation that none of us have ever thought we'd have. And all of us have, I think, considered beneficial.
Do you think of yourself, Mackie, as a historian? I mean, after a fashion, you are doing history.
Right.
You are doing, we put the word family in front
right.
of it. It's a genealogical as well as an artistic exercise.
Right.
Is there a historical angle here for you?
Sure, of course there is. But I think of myself more as a filmmaker, as an ordinary person. I'm a subject in this film as much as the maker of the film, which is problematic, but is the truth. I am doing history, yes. I'm doing history from the very personal perspective, and I think I'm doing it and have the right to do it as an any person from this perspective, because often it is the perspectives that I'm gathering that are rarely told in voices that mm-hmm. rarely get the chance to speak their histories.
Let's step back from the personal and the immediately historical, Mackie Alston. Your project is called Family Name. Tell me about some of the, they're not household names, but they are family names. Is it Charles Alston, who
right.
was a figure in the Harlem Renaissance? Why is he important to you?
Well, there's a bit of serendipity in, of course, all of this that I am doing. I was on a subway car in New York where I live reading Art News magazine and saw a image painted by a man named Charles Alston of the Selma March, and I thought my father was in that march. I wonder if they were there together, and I wonder what their connection is. Contacted his sisters. He has passed away. Contacted his sisters who live in New York as well and learned that his father, their father, was a slave on the plantation, one of the plantations that my family owned. As a filmmaker, Charles Alston provides wonderful material because he's a painter. He speaks through imagery, which is what I'm trying to do as well. So I'm weaving his paintings throughout the film. Luckily, too, because he was famous to an extent, there are recorded interviews and some filmed interviews that I am including in the film to bring him back to life through them.
If he were sitting at this table with us today, Mackie, what would you say to him? I'm sure that, well, I would hope that you have had such imaginary conversations with these characters. How about this man?
I'd say, what did your father hand down to you? What did you learn about your father, about his life as a child? I answer that because I've had so many conversations with his family that it wouldn't at this point be, how do you look at me? Could you ever like me? And will you converse with me? I think I'd jump that step just because perhaps he'd go along with answering my second question. The problem is that consider this, he died at age 70 in 1977. His father was a slave. Two generations ago, this family lived in the most, you know, outrageous oppression that I think our country has seen. It is that close to our lives today. So I would want to know the stories that were handed down. His sister, who was much younger, remembers really nothing. And again, imagine what is the case for their family. The father wanted to put that history behind. Mm-hmm. He wanted to give a better life to his family and his children, and so thought it best not to talk about it. However, his children were aware of the fact that the father had been a slave, and there had to have been some stories handed down. My team of researchers and I are now trying to bring this other person, his father's name was Primus Pris Alston, back to life too. However, our richest resource are human beings who can be the oral historians. Yeah.
Mackie, what's it like to go to an Alston family reunion these days? What happens? Is there anything special in the racial or human dynamic there that would set it apart from any other family reunion, other places in the country?
Yeah. Well, when I went to the Alston family reunion last September, I, in fact, went to two Alston family reunions happening the same week.
Black and white.
Black and white, right, in North Carolina. And that is an interesting way to do it. At the White family reunion, they had all read an article about Family Name, the film, in the Charlotte Observer, and they were all holding it as I walked up to them to introduce myself. And so they knew what I was about, and some got a kick out of it, some didn't.
It wasn't what you were going to ask them, it's what they expected to hear from you.
Exactly,
huh?
Exactly.
And what did you say?
Well, they got the first word. They said, so, you know, looking for black and white Alstons, digging around, you know, right, where you're not supposed to be digging. I think because I was younger than most of them, they thought, oh, this is a young upstart. Let's get a kick out of this. Mm-hmm. And the miracle, when I saw the article in their hands, I thought, oh, no, it's all dashed. I'm never going to be able to be as clandestine and as free to ask the questions I wanted to ask as I would have if my cover had not been blown. However, the truth of the matter is they cut right to the chase and brought up these issues, and each person, which is the wild truth behind this film, had a story about an associate, a maid, a friend or an acquaintance or a group of Alstons who were black and lived nearby. And then I went to the black reunion. The black reunion was less comfortable for me because I was the one white person there. And in fact, I was there with a film crew. So entirely conspicuous. They were remarkably gracious, and yet it was clear understanding, because they had heard that I was coming, they knew my story and that I descended from the people who owned their people. And I had some good conversations because I think they also realized that I was in it not to exploit, but instead to get to some truths that are rarely told.
The questions that you were putting to people, both black and white, Mackie, right. was it the fact that your skin is white? Was it the nature of the questions? What is it exactly that causes the discomfort here, the awareness of that line between black and white that is so hard for us to define?
Yeah. I think it's two things. It takes a lot, I think, to overcome what a white person represents in relation to trust. If I am having a conversation with an African-American person who has been raised in Pittsburgh, for example, it would take a lot for them really to come to trust me and confide in me. It's a lot to ask for
them. Well, is that because you're white or you're a stranger?
It's because both.
Uh-huh.
It's because both, and because I'm asking questions that are rarely asked. I mean, what could be my motives? Why break silence? Is it going to be dangerous for them? Why have we been socialized? Why have we been told not to answer these questions when asked and not to ask them?
It's as though they are tampering with history itself, right, somehow or other. They are doing something to their own pasts, right, that, jeopardizes the present and the future?
Yeah, but the other truth of the matter is this. One woman who was at the Black reunion said, you know, the reason we don't talk about this is because it's painful.
Mm-hmm.
So, how much more painful would it be to talk about it with me, who represents the oppressor?
Mackie Alston is a documentary filmmaker. His new project is Family Name. Family Name is scheduled for completion in March 1996. It will premiere at film festivals next spring, prior to its theatrical release and TV broadcast. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Audio tapes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 794. That's $10, program number 794. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, My Own Country. Physician and prize-winning writer Abraham Verghese will be here to talk about My Own Country, a doctor's story of battling the AIDS crisis in Johnson City, Tennessee. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.